The Catholic Church and National Geographic have both employed Dr. Mario Martinez to research stigmatas. His research and biocognitive theory are both telling. Cultural history can be as important as checking a heart rate regarding our well-being. I'm Robin Clare. Join us for Tributaries. I read an article that stated there have been more cases in the 20th century than ever before of the stigmata. Don't you think that that's due to the ability to communicate worldwide now?
Yes, that's possible. That's one of the reasons. But I think there are also some very interesting reasons. Well, first, 98% of them are Catholic, so it's very interesting how biology follows the culture. And about 60% or 70% are women. But what's happening now is that there's a greater need for a sense of spirituality because of what's happening in the world. And it usually happens around communities where there's something wrong, where there's a massive problem, or where people have lost faith. And I think the function of a stigmata is that not only does a person believe that they have this divine intervention, but that people begin to heal around them. They begin to have spontaneous healings for all kinds of illnesses. So it's like they're giving the community permission to trigger their own healing mechanism. But there's no question that the mass media and the communication system that we have now is much better. But there've only been, even with the 20th century, there've only been about 350 since St. Francis in the 13th century. So very rare.
Well, it's so funny to me that the Vatican declared the end of divine intervention after the apostles.
Yes, there was one pope, I think it may have been Gregory the Ninth, I believe, much later, who did declare that St. Francis was divine intervention, but that was the only stigmata that's been considered divine intervention.
Was Padre Pio the only one to be known to have had the same wounds as Jesus?
Well, there have been many that had it, but he was the most studied, and they found, for example, that he was bleeding about a cup of blood a day, and there was no anemia, and the wounds wouldn't heal, but they wouldn't get infected. And there were many, many recorded cases of spontaneous healings. Even now, when people go to his grave, they're reporting spontaneous healings.
We're getting awfully close into the mind and hypnotism and mesmerism and all of that. But before we really dive all into that sort of thing, are there any other traits that you can think of that these stigmatics do share? And is there ever any kind of trauma involved, for instance?
Well, they're all spiritual, not necessarily all religious, but they're all spiritual. And they all feel that they have a very close communication with divinity. But also, even more interesting about all of this is that they all share this model, what I call the medieval suffering model, where they can only come close to Christ by suffering. So that makes it one of the variables that's not necessarily a very good one. There was one that I investigated for National Geographic in Mexico City, and she had it was very unusual because she had the stigmata as a cross on her forehead, a perfect cross. And she was having spontaneous healings all around her. So I talked to her about considering a different model to see if she were willing to find closeness with Christ through love rather than through suffering. And during the filming, she began to have what's called the invisible stigmata, which is pain without the wounds. So I asked her if she wanted to get rid of it and then move into the model of joy, and she said she did. So we did some work, and it's the first time that science really been able to intervene in a stigmatic process, and it stopped. But then also what happened is that the spontaneous healing stopped. So the stigmata came back. So you see, it's a cultural co-authoring kind of thing, that people feel that they can only heal through suffering, or through the suffering of someone else. The paying for somebody else's guilt kind of thing, like what they call the sin eaters in the medieval times.
Yes.
So it's very fascinating to see how the cultures are still maintaining that sense of suffering. And by the way, I think the stigmata is not unique just to Catholics. I think what happens is it's manifested differently.
Yes.
An illness, for example, is a form of feeling a sense of guilt, or and that the only way that you can truly heal is through atoning with some suffering. I've seen that in many, many illnesses. And in fact, that's what I've learned from stigmata. What I've learned is the mind-body code, what I call the mind-body code. And I use that to treat fibromyalgia and depression and many other illnesses, especially autoimmune illnesses.
What did your work say to that woman that you worked with when the stigmata regressed after you did some work with her, asking her if she would rather relate to the joy?
Well, we talked, and I have stayed in touch with her, and she said that she felt helpless about it because she, of course, didn't request it, but it came, because I'm sure there was a subconscious process going on there. But she said that that was the only way that she felt that she could help people and that she was okay with getting it back, although she understood what I suggested was really the way to go. But she felt helpless because people wouldn't respond to her joy. They respond to her suffering. How interesting.
Yes. Well, there are other types of healers, as we know. There are the empathetic types where they actually take on that person's disease as it leaves the other person. And so it happens on all different levels. There are true spiritual healers that just basically don't even recognize the disease as being either real or even possible. They just don't even see it. And so they don't work like an empathetic healer who actually has to take on that disease for a little while in order to have it be released from someone else. And all of this is just testifies to what our minds are capable of. And unfortunately, I mean, Jesus led a full life, for instance, before he was put up on the cross. And he led a life of healing. And I don't recall hearing him getting super sick or anything. He just suffered on the cross. But
there was
a lot of love that people could pick up on from that as well, but they choose the suffering.
That's right, because the whole thing with, about Christ, I think, was not about suffering, it's about forgiveness. And I think that people confuse that. They think that that suffering is the way. What I think his message was not that we're here to suffer, but that we're here to forgive, because that's the last thing he did when he was on the cross. And but also that there's no need to live with that with that cross. Or by the way, all Eastern and Western have it. The Eastern people think that the Eastern have a different way. The Eastern have the same karmic idea that if they have to clean something up from the past, and that life is suffering and that kind of thing. So all I think belief systems have that sense that we're here to suffer, and we're moving on to a better place rather than being here and having a great life, and then a better place is icing on the cake.
Why do you think that is?
Because of the gods that we have learned to worship, from the Greek, especially if we're not just Judeo-Christian, we're Greco-Judeo-Christian, and when you look at all the gods, Eastern and Western, you just don't get too high. Sisyphus was punished for finding the secret of eternity, and Prometheus was punished, and you see that all the mythology, you find that you just don't get too high with the gods, and that the gods will punish you if you're not what they want you to be. So we just can't get to a point where we can feel, and I don't mean godlike, because we're not gods, you know, but to get to a point where you can allow yourself to bring your greatness out without feeling like you're going to be punished or that you're attempting to be God. And all religions have that. They all have that ceiling effect that I call, that you just don't get too high, because if you get too high, then something's going to happen here.
And ultimately, what do you feel like that has to do just with our mythology? Or is it just that people generally just get to a certain point and you can't handle so much power?
That's part of it, that we, because once you get to a point where you can you can accept your power, then you can no longer be a victim. You can no longer blame other people. You can no longer hold on to resentments. And that takes a lot of courage to do that. And in fact, when I worked with patients, the first thing that I do is to find out what they could do if they didn't have that illness. And that's what I work on, because they have a greater fear of whatever it is that they want to do than the illness. The illness, it's like a pass to obstruct the joy.
Did you ask that woman who was a stigmata from Mexico City that question?
I don't believe I asked that specific question, but I think that in her world, that was the only way that she felt that she could do her work.
Right.
Because she's so embraced into the culture that it's like fish asking the fish if they could understand that there's something beyond water. They wouldn't see anything beyond water. So it's a very entrenched, cultures are very entrenched, but also very subtle, very invisible.
Yes. Why do you think that the church is so invested in researching these stigmatics when they don't really believe there is divine intervention going on?
Well, because the position of the Vatican is that they don't want to make a circus atmosphere out of it. They want science to come in and look at it, and because there are many, many cases of hysterics and self-inflicted wounds, and then they claim all these divine intervention types of things that the Vatican's not in agreement with. So what they do is they leave it up to the individual and to call it a private intervention something that happened because of their faith or but not necessarily because God is, or Christ is, defining who should suffer or not. So it's really a very open way that they have about it, because they don't want to create false beliefs, and it's very dangerous when you have someone, for example, that self-inflicts a wound, who, because of their psychopathology, then they claim that there's some kind of a special divine being, or has been, that person has been designated as some kind of divine agent, when they're not, when they're pathologically sick.
I know as part of your research you've gone so far as testing the blood of a stigmatic, and I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that. As a researcher, I'm wondering also, you know, does the stigmata defy scientific explanation, or have you figured out a way to sort of incorporate all of that?
It defies it, yes, because, the first thing, that when Padre Pio was alive, they didn't have the immunological sophistication that we have now, so you couldn't really look at the immune system, nor did they even think of looking at the immune system. But what we found was with the blood, there's always been the question of whether it's the blood of Christ or the blood of the stigmatic. And in this case, it was the blood of the individual. She had A positive. So that question's been put to rest. Then we looked at the level of stress. We looked at the cortisol. The level of stress that person should be having should be very high, because to have a wound like that, that's a fairly stressful thing. Her cortisol was normal, which means that she was interpreting that as something that's not stressful. Second, we looked at neutrophils, which is the first defense that the body has to fight infections. And the neutrophils were normal, and yet she had no infection. We looked at the interleukins, which is the one that that does the repair, and the interleukins were normal also. And it shouldn't be that way. The neutrophil should have been very high, and the interleukin should have been very high, because there was a wound. There was a major wound there. And yet she had no anemia. In fact, she had more red blood cells than usual. Now, part of that was because she lived in Mexico, and people in high places, the red blood cells tend to be a little bit higher. So we couldn't really tell if it was because of the stigmata or because of the altitude, but she didn't have anemia, although she was bleeding. So what's happening is that the belief system is micromanaging the immune system and saying, don't let it get infected, but don't heal it. It's pretty remarkable.
You know, in talking about all of this suffering, I've you know, I remember hearing somewhere through these years about a young girl who was so enraptured and so embraced by love and light, she actually walked a little bit off of the ground. And so the whole opposite piece, are people researching, or do you know of cases where people just come from so much love that they have incredible healing capacities and or other seemingly outrageous abilities or capabilities?
Well, for example, back in the 16th century with Teresa of Avila, there were many reports of her levitating. In fact, the nuns would get very annoyed because they would have to bring her down when she was going up during her meditation. Cupertino, there were 60 sightings that were recorded about he levitating. And in quantum physics, there's a possibility of that happening, an anti-gravity process going on. But I think what happens with some people is that they reach such levels of exaltedness that they transcend the usual biological parameters that we have. And I think that that's available to anybody. But some people are able to access it easier than others. And you find that biology gets completely transcended when you have spontaneous healing, for example. In Mexico City, I investigated with a physician crediting this and validating it, that because of this woman, the stigmatic, there was one case of a man who was cured of prostate cancer and a boy who was cured of leukemia. 6 months later, they were still in remission, and the physician couldn't understand what was going on. I asked her, what do you make of this? She said, it's got to be a miracle, because we don't learn anything, and we don't see anything like this in medical school.
Is that the most healing, the most amazing healing that you've seen or taken part in?
That I've seen, yes, but now there have been others that are more dramatic. One in at Lourdes, this man had an autoimmune illness that was actually attacking his own hip, and he had lost most of the hip. And they had x-rays of before, and then he went to Lourdes. He came back. When he came back, they took the cast off, and the bone was completely healed. He had a complete hip. In cases like that, when there's medical evidence that's irrefutable medical evidence, then there's a commission of scientists that consider that to be a miracle. And that was accredited to be a miracle. Right. And that transcends biological parameters. You don't have that kind of bone reconstruction. And if it were to happen, it doesn't happen overnight. So obviously there's something beyond the known parameters of biology that we study in science.
Right. Well, this is where I just start getting really excited, because I feel like I know all of this. Obviously, it's happening all of the time, all over the place. And I wonder often if the scientific process doesn't even sort of slow it down in its need to try to explain it all. I mean, I just think there's an explanation, but it isn't necessarily a scientific explanation.
Oh, it slows it down because science can only go with the empirical method of what you can see or what the extensions of your eyes can see, like an MRI or an X-ray and so forth. And it can only go so far, and that reality will only go so far, so you move at the speed of the instruments of science. So definitely that's what's happening. And definitely there's a consciousness of a ceiling effect, where if you are treating an illness and if you are able to come up with a medication that heals the illness, you're out of business. So although there's not a conspiracy, I don't think that pharmaceuticals and scientists are conspiring to not cure, but there's a consciousness that doesn't allow them to cure because the socioeconomics comes in.
Right. I heard this great quote from, I think it was a researcher from the 20th century that said, if you're going to try a new remedy, use it right when it's been made, because then it doesn't have all of the known side effects known to everybody. So.
Oh, yes. No, that's a big joke in medicine. They say when the medicine comes out, use it before it stops working.
Right. So. Well, I just love the work that you're doing with the biocognition, and you've just brilliantly taken it so many steps. And I wonder if you could maybe share a little bit more with us about the codes that you talk about.
Well, what I was trying to do is to, since stigmata is such a process that transcends biology so quickly and it has to do with cultures, I began to look at the components of the culture and how the culture affects our biology, and started looking at other cultures and with cultural anthropology, medical anthropology, and so forth. And the code, what I found is that what I call the biocognitive code is that you have to have several elements for things to work. Number one, you have to be an authority within a culture for the effect to work. For example, with hexing, if you go to Haiti and a voodoo doctor tells you that you're hexed, unless they put some chemical in it, nothing's going to happen to you because you don't share the culture and you don't share the belief that that person is an authority in your culture. That's the first component. The second is that after it happens, you have to have some belief that it's happening. And third is that the culture has to support it afterwards. And an example of that would be a man goes to a doctor and he has an inoperable tumor. And the doctor, this happened back in the 70s, this doctor told him, look, we have this medication that just came out that is just like Pac-Man. In those days, Pac-Man was the deal. And
I remember.
So he said, it's going to eat it like Pac-Man. So he goes home. Within 2 weeks, the tumor's gone. And then later, he reads in the paper that medication really had no effect, that it had been totally bogus. The tumor came back. He goes to the doctor. See, that's the part where the culture has to support it. And the doctor says, who's a very good doctor, he said, well, look, you're right. We thought that was going to be very strong, but we have something even stronger now. And we really found something now, and we fixed whatever the problem had, because the other one only worked for a while, and then it stopped working. See, the placebo effect. So he gives him the medication, and again, the tumor's gone within a few weeks. But then, about 6 months later, he reads in the paper that medication also did not have a lasting effect. The tumor comes back, and he dies.
He should have stopped reading the paper.
I know. Well, that's why you should, absolutely, not only the paper, but the news.
Right, yeah. Except public radio, of course, right? Which is
well,
where we are.
Depending. They're all getting very negative and very cynical about the world. They can only report what's not working. But you know, most public radio is a lot better in that sense, that they don't contaminate as much.
Yes. Now, what is the process for overriding the cultural influence?
That you have to find power within that culture, because there's always a counter power within that culture that allows you to transcend the limitations. So, for example, a healer in the culture or a spiritual belief within the culture. But it has to be within the culture because it's so much of the fabric. Biology and culture are one fabric. They're inseparable. And this work can be done. There are techniques that are developed, and have some things that I do also that work, but it's very difficult because the culture is more powerful than your genes. Genetically, we're not. When they tried to find an answer for everything, the alcohol gene and that gene, I knew they were going to fail miserably.
Right, that was a joke.
But they did it, and they came up where they thought, well, we're going to have many, many hundreds of thousands of genes because the body makes at least 300,000 proteins, and the immune system fights millions and millions of viruses, and all they found was 23,000 genes.
That's all?
That's it.
That kept somebody up very light one
night.
That's
right, and they were very disappointed because they thought, oh, and that's reductionistic science. They want to bring everything to the smallest component and then explain everything from there, and it doesn't work that way.
Well, ultimately, isn't that the same with cause and effect? I mean, my gosh, how can we actually find the real true cause of anything?
It's the cause that we're comfortable with. It's what it is. It's that we focus on many things, and then we create like a little tunnel, and we say that's the cause and effect, but it's a multivariable kind of thing that goes on. And we can only identify a certain amount. And in science, you have to, because otherwise you don't go anywhere. But at the same time, science is very arrogant and very narrow-minded.
Yeah, I mean, we don't necessarily have to ride the science train. There's other transportation.
Oh, of course, of course. And especially when it fails. When it fails, because medicine is miraculous when it comes to acute kinds of problems, but it fails miserably with systemic problems. There was someone who said I think it was Chopra who said that there are more people living off cancer than dying off cancer. And it's true. Not because it's a malicious conspiracy. It's a consciousness of limitation.
Yes. And the fear factor.
Of course, a fear factor is. And there was one study that looked at, for example, the biases that Maslow said, the humanist psychologist said that when you look at the world with a hammer, all you see is nails. So this person was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and he went from one specialist to another. The chemotherapist suggested chemotherapy. The surgeon suggested surgery. And the herbalist suggested herbs. So it's not just a conventional medicine. The complementary medicine is the same. It's all external.
Right. I've heard that if you look at the statistics of success rates, the Western medical model, the metaphysical, and then the pure spiritual, they all have the same statistics as far as being successful or not.
Yes. Well, especially in the acute, medicine is definitely way ahead. You break a leg, don't go to a shaman. Go to an orthopedic surgeon. But and systemically, yes, I think systemic is even some of the complementaries do better. In psychiatry, for example, there's tremendous overuse of medication, tremendous overuse
of course, yes.
ADHD medication and depression and anxieties and things that are just treated strictly as if you were some kind of chemical being rather than an individual who has chemistry and consciousness.
Right. Well, Mario, I know your knowledge of medical anthropology is vast, and obviously you've studied many, many cultures. And I'm wondering, is there a meeting place from the ancient, for instance, ancient Tibetan Buddhist psychology and that place of medical anthropology and what you're doing with your models of the codes?
Yes, and that's what biocognition is about. Biocognition brings psychoneuroimmunology in, cultural anthropology or medical anthropology, and neuroscience. So it's bringing in mind-body culture or mind-body spirit within a culture. So I think it's all complementary. No one has the answer.
And is there any culture that seems ultimately healthier than others that you've been able to zero in on?
No. They all have their problems. I mean, I love the Tibetan Buddhist psychology and all that, but they have their problems too.
Right, yes.
So there's not one culture. They all have their positives and their negatives, and the idea is to bring them together so we can have a common knowledge and a common truth.
Right now we're going to sit with, virtually anyway, a class of kindergartners. What would you do to lift them out of culture that's already basically enveloped them?
One of the things is that that children are basically in theta and delta waves. They can believe anything, and they sometimes have visions and things. And rather than and that's a developmental process. They go through that and they go into beta. And when they become adolescents, they know everything. Nobody can teach them anything, that type of thing. But what I would do is encourage them to explore that that type of what's called conditional learning that is not explored very much in schools. We teach unconditional learning. For example, we say a pair of glasses is only to see. That's it. The conditional learning says this is a pair of glasses, and if you need to, you can use it to stir your coffee, or you can use it to light a fire, and on and on and on. So what it does is it expands cognition. That's what geniuses are all about, people that see things differently. And they see angles that other people don't see because of that narrow-mindedness that we teach.
Where has this left you spiritually?
Well, the more science I learn, the more spiritual I become.
Dr. Mario Martinez, a wise man. Anything you need regarding this is at tributariesradio.wordpress.com, iTunes for podcasting, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.